thought it was peculiar that they were stating the mission as something that was different from a written mission on the DNR website.
The Department of Natural Resources changes their mission statement. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers propose strengthening Alaska's law banning texting while driving.
Drivers who text while they drive are 20 times more likely to have an accident than people who don't text.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Parents of students in rural Alaska schools have settled their litigation with the state over the level of state support required by the Constitution. The Moore versus State case, filed in 2004, challenged the state's use of funding and standards in dealing with the lowest achieving schools. The state lost the original case as Superior Court Judge Sharon Gleason ruled that the state had failed in meeting its responsibilities to those schools. Today's settlement sets up a method for the Department of Education and local school districts to work together to focus resources on the state's 40 lowest performing schools. Education Commissioner Mike Hanley said negotiations in recent months have been based on the idea that neither the state nor the plaintiffs should be seen as winners or losers.
The Moore settlement stated that it will need an $18 million one-time appropriation. The design has been that it would provide funding for several years and would lay a foundation that we could look to and a model that we could look to in the future for a successful program and for successful pedagogical strategies that would make a difference for our kids.
The group Citizens for Educational Advancement of Alaska's Children took the lead on the case by coordinating the schools, the plaintiffs, and the attorneys. Executive Director Charles Woolforth, who signed the settlement documents in the Attorney General's office this afternoon, said they continue to push the state for what they thought would work to erase what he called a waste of human potential when children are not given a chance.
So, have we solved all the problems with rural education and with some of our struggling schools in Alaska? Well, I think the answer would be no. $18 million clearly is not going to be enough to solve this broad span of problems. But I think what we'll do, and the commissioner alluded to it, is we're going to demonstrate some programs, we're going to work on them collaboratively, and then we're going to see that they work. We're going to prove that this is the right way to go. And it's new hope for rural kids in these schools across Alaska.
The settlement specifically sets up a committee appointed by SEAC and the Department of Education to determine how resources should be shared to meet the outlines in the court's decision. Although it's not official yet, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources has announced its intention to change its mission statement. Recently, administrators quietly removed the words conserve and enhance from the statement, leaving only the word develop to describe how resources should be managed. Even a Republican lawmaker has concerns about the change, and as KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, legislators will soon begin weighing in on the issue.
DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan says there's one reason he decided to change the agency's mission statement, because he wants the mission to be more closely aligned with the state's constitution.
Particularly the policy statement in Article 8, Section 1.
That's the part that reads,
to encourage the settlement of its lands and the development of its resources by making them available for maximum use consistent with the public interest.
The old mission statement reads that DNR's mission was to develop, conserve, and enhance natural resources for present and future Alaskans. The words conserve and enhance have been dropped, along with the reference to future Alaskans. Sullivan served as Attorney General for a year before he was appointed Commissioner of DNR by Governor Sean Parnell in 2010. His staff says this is not the first time DNR's mission statement has changed. They say there were three revisions in the past decade alone. Sullivan issued the change on January 17th. News of the revision has conservation groups concerned, says Trish Wolf with Trustees for Alaska.
It concerns me not just from my organizational standpoint, but from a longtime Alaskan. It is in our Constitution that we utilize, develop, and conserve all the natural resources belonging to the state. You know, you don't get to just use the first two and forget the third one, the conservation part of it.
Changing the wording of the mission also worries Bob Shavelson with Cook Inlet Keeper. He says he noticed the change to the mission a few weeks ago.
My staff brought it to my attention several weeks ago from a PowerPoint presentation that Commissioner Sullivan had given, and he just thought it was peculiar that they were stating the mission as something that was different from the written mission on the DNR website. And then just this past week, we saw, well, in fact, they had unilaterally gone and changed their mission.
That change in wording, Shavelson says, gives the mission a pro-development slant. And it's something he says should also concern the legislature.
One of the concerns that members of the legislature may have is that you have an executive agency that may or may not have some political motivations in making that change. So it should fall in the prerogative of the legislature to do that, because under the notion of separation of powers, that falls within the legal duty of the legislature.
And some legislators are concerned. Sullivan presented the new mission to them on January 20th at a meeting of the House Resources Committee in Juneau. During that meeting, Representative Paul Seaton of Homer questioned the change. He says it deserves a thorough review.
I want to make sure that we are developing in a responsible way. We also don't exclude conserving and enhancing our natural resources or future Alaskans. And that's something that is left out of the proposed mission statement by DNR.
Seaton says he expects Commissioner Sullivan to provide more information about the proposed changes to the mission, the reasoning behind it, and possible impacts. He also claims statutes give the legislature, not DNR, the responsibility to issue a mission statement.
The legislature sets the mission statements. It has not adopted this mission statement. The old mission statement will still be operative until the legislature changes the mission statement.
The Alaska Department of Natural Resources is responsible for managing the state's vast energy and natural resources and overseeing regulatory activities on approximately 100 million acres of uplands, 60 million acres of tidelands, shorelands and submerged lands, and 40,000 miles of coastline. Seaton says legislators hope to begin addressing the proposed changes to DNR's mission statement in the coming weeks. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
State Senate President Gary Stevens says nothing is more important this legislative session than coming to agreement on oil tax legislation. The Senate's bipartisan coalition is writing its own bill to counter Governor Sean Parnell's proposal to reduce Alaska's oil profits by giving producers major tax breaks. Stevens says the Senate Resources version will be drafted in about a week and a half. Fairbanks Democrat Joe Paskvan, co-chair of the Senate Resources Committee, says Alaska will still behave as an owner state.
You know, we are different than most other jurisdictions in the United States, and we need to act like a sophisticated owner with a world-class resource.
While details are scarce, senators say the bill will include a progressive surtax, surcharge, and tax credits. They told reporters today that they've been discussing their approach with the governor, and the two sides may be closer than expected. Senator Hollis French says the promise of more oil industry jobs for Alaskans will help bridge the gap between the two sides. A report commissioned by the Senate indicates the administration was wrong last year when it claimed oil industry jobs were being shipped out of Alaska to other oil-rich states. According to the McDowell Group report, average annual employment on Alaska's North Slope was at a 20-year high in 2010. 35 states have banned texting while driving, and Alaska thought it had too. but some judges say the law passed in 2008 is not clear. So legislation is on the move that specifically prohibits drivers from reading or typing a text, email, or other message while their vehicle is in motion. A Fairbanks training judge has advised magistrates to refuse cases involving texting while driving, and a Kenai judge has thrown out a case against a driver for texting. That case is on appeal. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra told the House Transportation Committee today that lawmakers should not wait for a court ruling.
I think you only really need one fact, and that is, according to the National Conference on State Legislators, drivers who text while they drive are 20 times more likely to have an accident than people who don't text.
Guerra says the issue of texting while driving has been taken up by the national organization Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
It's the new drunk driving.
After a brief hearing, House Bill 255 moved out of the Transportation Committee, bound for judiciary. The legislation states that texting is illegal while the vehicle is in motion. Guerra said reading or sending a text while sitting in a parked vehicle should not be a crime. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searching for innovative solutions for getting sanitation systems to every rural village.
What are the options that we've never thought about? What are the directions we should go in and look and see if it's feasible?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Crews in the St. Lawrence Island community of Savoonga are digging to reach contaminated snow after a fuel tank overflowed last Thursday and spilled thousands of gallons of diesel into a containment area. No fuel has breached the containment area. The operator for the Native Village of Savoonga Tank Farm reports that a new employee opened the wrong valve during a gasoline purchase and pumped diesel fuel into a full tank, resulting in the overflow. Wesley Gormley is an environmental program specialist for the State Department of Environmental Conservation and is monitoring the response for the state.
The tank farm liner is sound. They are pumping the recovered fuel into a 27,000-gallon tank within the tank farm.
Gormley says workers have collected 6,000 gallons so far. They've removed about 100 cubic yards of uncontaminated snow, but have yet to get into the contaminated snow. Gormley says he expects a significant amount of fuel-soaked snow, which will be stored in 270-gallon totes.
And that'll remain within the secondary containment of the tank farm until this summer, when the snow melts and we can recover the fuel.
The recovered diesel will be able to be used after a filtering process. Gormley expects another week of work to remove snow. He says the fumes are strong and crews are wearing full protective gear and using respirators. DEC plans to send a representative out during spring thaw to complete a site assessment. For almost a week, students at a Bethel Elementary School have had to brave the cold and walk outside to a separate building just to use the restroom. That changed this week when the school finally got enough running water to flush the toilets. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
School's been back in session since January 19th, but Magilangut Litnauvet Elementary School has had to hold classes without functioning restrooms in the building. Students and staff have had to walk to separate buildings about 100 yards away just to use the bathroom. For a while, it was hard for the Lower Kuskokwim School District Maintenance Department to pinpoint the problem. But with the help of the city and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Maintenance Department, the water is finally flowing.
Thought it was a broken pipe. It ended up being, luckily, a frozen pipe that was preventing us from getting water.
That's ME Elementary Principal Joshua Gill, who says it's a relief to finally have running water in the building. Before, the school had to rely on mobile hand-washing stations consisting of water coolers that flowed into drip buckets. LKSD Superintendent Gary Baldwin said the fix took longer than expected because they couldn't find a particular section of frozen pipe.
Well, they finally got heat to the right location on the pipes that were leading to ME school, it was in a utilidor.
Baldwin says utilidors are boxes that insulate sections of pipe. He says since the frozen section was hidden inside the utilidor, it was difficult to thaw. Gill says his students, ranging from kindergarten to second grade, are happy they don't have to walk very far to go to the restroom.
Yesterday we had a limited water flow to a small portion of our campus. I think we were getting 8 gallons per minute. And today, I think when I checked earlier, we were running about 42 gallons per minute.
All LKSD water and sewers fully functioning, except for parts of Bethel Regional High School. Last year, Governor Sean Parnell vetoed a nearly $7 million plan for improving LKSD's water and sewer system. But it's back in his proposed budget for this year. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Residents in a few dozen rural villages in Alaska are still using honey buckets, and with declining federal funds, that isn't likely to change anytime soon. But a group of state, tribal, and federal representatives met at a workshop in Anchorage today to try to find innovative solutions to the problem. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The state and federal government subsidize a lot of things in rural Alaska, phone service, power, even the mail. But one thing is noticeably absent from that list.
We still don't have some basic sanitation needs that are being met with any subsidy to help make them affordable.
Bob White sees the consequence of that in his day-to-day work. As a remote maintenance worker for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, he travels to more than a dozen villages. He says some have fully piped sewer systems, but others are still using honey buckets, hauling waste to a sewage lagoon.
They may make it out of the house with it all sealed up, but somewhere throughout the village, it's being spilled in that transportation process on the roads, on the boardwalks. Dogs or kids or people are tracking that. It gets on four-wheelers. During the summer, turns into dust and basically flies through the air.
Villages using honey buckets have higher rates of respiratory illness, and one of the main goals of the workshop is to improve health outcomes in rural Alaska with better sanitation systems. But that isn't easy to achieve. Cheryl Rosa is deputy director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and helped organize the workshop.
We're down to 29 to 31 villages that are considered the hard cases. These are the unserved communities that pretty much, if it was fixable or doable, it's been done, and now we've got these holdout villages.
Rosa says the solution for these villages is probably a decentralized system. It just isn't cost-effective to run pipe to every home in a small, remote community. Centralized systems are expensive to both build and maintain. Dennis Wagner with the Environmental Protection Agency explains.
The biggest cost in running a water system in rural Alaska is energy. And so heating the water from a centralized facility to the homes and then returning it and reheating it again so it doesn't freeze is very expensive. So a decentralized facility would take that environment or that energy component out and make it more affordable for the individual homeowners.
But no one knows exactly what that decentralized system would look like. And any system will have to be affordable for the community. Wagner says the amount of federal funds available to help is shrinking. He says Alaska needs to consider innovative solutions.
What are the options that we've never thought about? What are the directions we should go in and look and see if it's feasible or if there's a better alternative that we've never thought about that's not being used in Alaska or anywhere else in the world? Is there something better that we should be looking at doing some research and development on?
And that's one of the main purposes of the workshop, to get people who know this issue well, sharing ideas on how to solve the problem. Cheryl Rosa says after last year's workshop, participants talked about one major benefit.
We got to sit down in a room with people that we don't usually sit down with. So, and that was really surprising to me, because you would think, hey, Alaska's a pretty small state, and all these people must talk to each other. I think they talk to each other, but I don't know that they sit down in this kind of atmosphere and kind of work over potential solutions to problems.
Even though the problem is a difficult one, Rosa says giving up is not an option. She says Alaskans deserve access to good sanitation and the health benefits that come with it. She's hoping the workshop will inspire ideas and provide momentum for moving forward. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Halibut management scientists this week reprised concerns that they've been overestimating halibut stocks for several years and repeated their recommendation for a 19% overall cut to the coastwide catch for this year. As a region, though, Southeast would see a small increase after 6 years of dropping quotas. The International Pacific Halibut Commission's meeting is underway this week in Anchorage. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has more on the staff presentations.
Estimating fish stocks involves a lot of uncertainty, according to commission staffers. They detailed the problems through 4 hours of technical presentations Tuesday. In retrospect, they think the commission has allowed too much harvest on a declining stock in recent years. Scientist Juan Valero explained that as the staff assesses the current halibut biomass each year, it also uses more current information to revise estimates from past years as well. Through this, they have found that they have consistently overestimated the overall poundage of halibut since at least 2005, while underestimating catches. The problem's called retrospective bias.
The retrospective bias occurs when we realize that what we thought we knew in the past, actually it is not. It has been overestimated or underestimated.
So, for example, Valero said the staff reduced last year's biomass estimate by 25% after the stock estimate for this year. Had they known they were at that level at the time, according to Valero, they would have reduced the harvest rate. He and other scientists said they are working on new management approaches and policies so they can prevent the problem in future assessments.
But in the meantime, what do we do? Because the retrospective bias is there, or has been there, and is estimated to potentially to be ongoing. So what are we working here are, if you will, a way to treat the symptom if we cannot find the cure, if we cannot find the cure as of now.
Valero described one such Band-Aid approach, revise current harvest levels based on the maximum overestimate from the previous year. In the case of 2012, that could mean cutting the harvest roughly in half. However, staff did not go so far as to recommend that much of a change for this year. Bruce Lehman is the IPHC's executive director.
We have a lot of work in front of us, I believe, in terms of trying to solve the retrospective issue, which is the primary thing that we need to do. We could apply the sort of fix that has been outlined for you, but that is not designed to try and solve the retrospective problem, which is the serious issue here that we need to deal with.
Another part of the problem, as Lehman and other scientists have explained before, is the declining size of halibut at age. The fish are taking longer to grow big enough to harvest. Lehman pointed out that halibut growth is something managers cannot control. Lehman went through the recommended catch levels for 2012, which are the same as those he first presented late last year during the commission's interim meeting. Overall, the coastwide catch would drop about 19% from 41 million pounds to 33 million. The commission meeting is slated to wind up late Friday morning after a vote on the catch recommendations and other proposals, which ultimately have to be approved by the federal governments in the U.S. and Canada. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Anchorage's Folk Festival is in its 23rd year. The annual event banishes wintertime blahs with hot bluegrass music, folk tunes, and fiddle dances. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Mid-January's sub-zero cold snap does little to keep people away from the Anchorage Folk Festival. The event spans 2 4-day weekends at UA Anchorage's Wendy Williamson Auditorium. The weekends are linked by midweek evening performances at a string of local coffee houses. Kenny Powers, AFF board member, outreach chair, and dance coordinator, says the festival is open to everyone. Powers says although the festival leans toward bluegrass music, all types of local performers are welcome.
For the local performers, and we have like 130 different performers, most of them from the Anchorage area, but they come up from the Kenai, up from the southeast, down from Fairbanks, and so forth. They're really, it's a state festival in many ways, but they play folk music, and we put on all comers. Everybody gets their 15 minutes of fame.
What does it take to get on stage?
The desire to get out there and either your own willingness to perform alone or some bandmates. So there's no particular level of performers that you need to be. Kids come out, they're just starting. My daughter, who's 11, put a band together this year, and they performed this year for the first time performing ever. And so they just put their band together, practice.
Besides the local talent, invited professional bands anchor the performances, a different one each weekend of the festival. This weekend, a former Alaskan returns home with his band to headline the show. Frank Sullivan fronts the group, Dirty Kitchen. Sullivan sings and plays fiddle and mandolin.
Chose Frank Sullivan this year. He's a bluegrass primarily, but he plays blues and other things because we hadn't had a headliner doing that. Last weekend's headliner, Hanukkah Castle, is an Irish fiddler, played all sorts of Celtic sort of music.
Now living in the Washington, D.C. area, Sullivan spent many years as a fiddle instructor in Alaska.
So a lot of local people know him. He's taught at Alaska Folk Arts Camp several years, so a lot of the musicians here locally have learned from him.
Dirty Kitchen plays the main stage at the festival on Friday evening, Saturday afternoon, and again on Sunday evening. The band also provides live music for various dances and workshops throughout the weekend. Powers says although bluegrass and old-timey music seem to be perennial crowd-pleasers, the festival is not exclusively American roots-based. He says the Anchorage Folk Festival is making efforts to include music with international flair in the future. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Travel around, pick my strings from town to town, feeling like I paid.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Nome, Mark Earhart in Bethel, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. And finally tonight, we have the sad task of saying goodbye to our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Libby Casey. The APRN network and our listeners throughout the state have benefited greatly from Libby's stellar reporting for nearly 4 years. Libby covered major Alaska news in that time and did so with clear writing, accuracy, and analysis that helped us better understand the important stories affecting Alaska that flow from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Libby, for your dedication to APRN News, and good luck in your future adventures.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by ConocoPhillips Alaska and Mattsu Health Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.